Hey friends, it's Eric Sorensen, co-host of 30 Minutes in the New Testament, here with a special announcement. And that announcement is that 30 Minutes in the New Testament can now be found on YouTube. If you click on the link in the show notes here just below me, you're going to see that we have our own YouTube page. And the reason we're doing that is because from now on, we're going to be recording not just audio of the episodes, which will continue on the various podcast platforms that you use, but we're also going to film our episodes so that you can access video. And so make sure to click on that link, subscribe today so you can keep up with all the clips we release and all our future episodes. Thanks so much.
Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast, network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you're checking out everything else that 1517 is doing. So much stuff, articles, events, academies, videos, do all that. Hey, you know what you could do? Also, if I don't know if you listen to 30 Minutes in the New Testament. You could listen to that show. It's like the sister show to this show. There's no Chad, but there is me. And so, you know, if Chad's the only reason you're here, then yeah, I get it. But, you know, if it's not that way, you could listen to 30 Minutes in the New Testament. And it is doing something new where it's we actually are going through the process of videoing all of those podcasts. So it's not just an audio podcast, but you can watch it on YouTube. So if you're looking for something to watch on YouTube, little New Testament Bible study, you can go to YouTube and search up 30 Minutes in the New Testament. There should be a link in the show notes as well, and you can check that out. You know, even if you're not that interested, you should just go there and subscribe, because that helps us out. So why don't you do that? Do it for me. Do it for me. If you never do anything else for me your whole life, you could go over to YouTube and subscribe to 30 Minutes in the New Testament. I'd appreciate it. All right, Chad, we are in Job chapter 32. And Job has made his final appeal. At least that's what the ESV tells us. He has made his appeal. And, you know, you kind of maybe feel like things are wrapping up. Like okay, Job's final appeal. We must be nearing the end here. We're going to get the conclusion. And out of nowhere, we just have a guy parachute in. And he's got some thoughts. And no one seems to care about his thoughts. No one seems to think that his thoughts are worth listening to, or maybe they're just so exhausted by this conversation at this point that they just can't take anymore. But we are going to be introduced to Elihu, who is, this guy is just thinks he's right. He's got it figured out.
He could be quite an entertaining research to read the commentaries on Job with regard to this guy, because it is kind of all over the place. People's perspective and opinions with regard to him, especially his character. I mean, his words too, but just kind of the overall portrayal of him. I mean, you come across things like, bombastic, arrogant, what do you call the people? The backseat drivers, you know, he's the guy that has everything figured out. I mean, you just on and on and on this list of descriptions, negative descriptions of him. And some of these are, I think, somewhat fair. Some of them are a little bit unfair. But you will find that kind of negative portrayals of him. And then, interestingly, you will find also people that think he is a type of Christ. As if he is the one who is going to come in, parachute in, as you said, and is going to be dropping wisdom left and right. And that he is, in fact, purposely portrayed here as a type of the second person of the Trinity. So you got those kind of arguments. In fact, I find it interesting. Anytime I post about Job or specifically Elihu on my social media channels, there's always one or two comments that pop up with people who have that perspective, which was something new to me. But that is, I've done a little looking myself, and there are a few people who advocate for that. I don't find it convincing whatsoever. As will become clear as we work our way through these chapters. But I just put that out there because he is one of these people in Job, unlike Job's three friends, where everybody pretty much agrees. But he is one of these people where you have a wide range of opinions with regard to his wisdom or lack thereof, his character, good or bad. So we'll, I guess we'll see as we work our way through this what kind of opinion we end up with. But I'll be up front in saying that he's like the three friends and that he says some things which are true. He says some things which are half true, half false, and some things which are just outright false. But from my perspective, there's one thing which is for sure is that he's very certain that he's right and everybody else is wrong.
Yeah, the trouble with a view of him being like here comes Jesus is that yeah, I think he just says some things that are obviously not true. And so that makes it tough.
Sure
Like
does.
I don't know, but he's just straight wrong about some things. So that makes it tough. Also, one of the things that's weird about him is that you assume he's been here like for the whole time. I mean, like he parachutes into the narrative here, but like you get the impression, at least I get the impression, that this is a guy that has become increasingly frustrated as he's listened to this side. So, like, you almost think of him like sitting in the background, listening to all this, and chapter 32 is where he's had enough, and he just blows his lid, right? Like, so, and it's like, everyone shut up and listen to me. Like, I've been listening to this for all this time, and he's, I mean, because he's mad at everyone. I mean, he's mad at Job. He's mad at Job's three friends because he thinks that they've done a poor job in their argumentation. It's yeah, this is a guy. I guess he's just been sitting there, just getting hotter and hotter and hotter.
I went to seminary with a guy who, if he got upset, you would see this red begin to work his way from his neck upward all the way into his face. And by the time he was really worked up, he looked like a tomato. I mean, he was as red can be. And you could see it just gradually ascending his neck and face. And that's kind of the way I picture Elihu here. He's sitting in the background. It's almost like you have, I mean, he might not have been the only one who's listening to this back and forth. And yeah, he's just listening and he's shaking his head at first, like, you guys, you should be saying this or you should be saying that. And then Joe speaks and he gets even angrier. And then finally, he says, you know what? Enough is enough. I'm going to step up here. These old people don't know what they're talking about. I'm going to, even though I'm young, I've bided my time and it's time for me to speak.
You do feel like Job's probably, an older guy, not necessarily an old man. When I think of Job, I think of someone like my age, like some dude in his 40s or something like that. I think of his friends being the same. This guy seems like he's 23 years old.
Well, he's
Like,
definitely younger. I mean, we see that. I am young in years, he says in verse six. How young? I mean, we don't know. Younger than
these
Job,
guys.
Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. So relatively younger anyway. Okay, so I don't know where here comes Elihu. And by the way, as people probably realize, once he finishes his speeches, which will comprise quite a bit, he's going to be talking from chapter 32 onward. He's got five chapters here. Longest uninterrupted speech, by the way, of anybody in the whole book, even God. He doesn't speak this long uninterruptedly, so he's got a lot to say. But once he's finished, it's it. He's God doesn't address him. There's no mention of him in the closing part of the book of Job. He just pops in, has his long speech, pops out, and that's it. So anyway, verse 32, chapter 32. Here's the kind of the setup. First five verses say, so these three men, of course, talking here about Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. He burned with anger also at Job's three friends because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three friends, guess what? He burned with anger. So, in case you didn't miss it, he's angry. One, two, three, four times we're told in this opening five verse section that we have a young, angry theologian on our hands who's about to speak, which will happen in verse six.
There's one phrase here that's a little that I think is a little bit hard, because typically when you hear it, you don't you have you think of something very negative. I mean, they're in verse
Righteous in
one.
his own eyes,
Yeah,
that
so
one.
like, so you have the, you have that just sort of pause, right? So Job makes his final appeal, and there's a pause, and this is where Elihu's going to break in this pause and take his opportunity. But the reason it gives for the pause that they're not going to answer Job's final appeal, because it says, because Job is righteous in his own eyes. Now, typically, Chad, if like you or I were to say that so and so is righteous in their own eyes, what we mean is that they think they're righteous, but they certainly are not. Or we would we, this is to me anyway, this is associated with self-righteousness, like it's the opposite of righteousness, right? But I don't think that's what it means here. I think that it might be what they perceive it. They're like, well, the Job just thinks he's righteous. It is, of course, possible to believe that your cause is righteous and be correct about it. It just isn't typically the case.
Yeah, I think it's hard to get past that negativity associated with this. But yeah, it's basically saying these three guys cease to answer Job because Job was convinced and argued convincingly that he was in the right, that he had not sinned, and that he was not guilty of some deep, dark secret that God was punishing him for. And when it says, you know, he justified himself rather than God, it's just basically it's accurate in the sense of, yeah, Job is saying that he does not see how God could be in the right when Job doesn't see himself being in the wrong, more or less.
And some of this
So,
also is the, I think you have to read this also as the perception of the people, right? Like, so these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Okay, well, Job definitely thinks his cause is righteous, but it's also describing how they view Job as someone who they probably do think he's self-righteous. They're like, man, this guy's just not going to back down from this. I haven't done anything, and you know, and Elihu's mad at Job. Because he justified himself rather than God. That's now you could say like, well, Job is justifying himself, but of course Job's the one that's suffering here, not God. And he is upset with God. But this is Elihu's perception of it, is that like, oh, well, Job is making himself feel like sound like the just one and questioning the justice of God. I mean, I just can't let this stand.
That's very accurate. So sometimes we have reported the perspective of someone who's about to speak. It doesn't mean it's necessarily the objective perspective, but this is his perspective on Job as well as his three friends. So with that introduction telling us he's very upset, he's angry at everybody, basically. He's angry at Job, he's angry at Job's three friends. Then he's going to talk. Now, Elihu it does, I think, earn and deserve the reputation of being a bit windy, a bit loquacious. He's like Captain Thesaurus because he's going to heap up all these words over and over until he really, honestly, until he really has anything to add. He's got this long preface, and it's going to begin with chapter 32, verse 6, where he's going to basically argue in three different ways that he here's the way one commentator paraphrased it. In verses 6 through 10, he's going to tell them more or less, "I want to speak." Verses 11 through 14, he's going to tell them, "I can speak," and then verses 15 through the rest of the chapter, "I must speak." And that's really all he's going to say. He's going to heap up a lot of words to communicate this, but that's what he's getting across in verse 6 through 22. "I want to speak, I can speak, and I must speak." And so you kind of get the impression that he, I don't know if he's trying to convince himself or if he's trying to convince Job and the three friends that he should be part of this conversation. He should be part of this dialogue. But this is the way he goes about it. So I'll start out here with verse 6. Elihu, the son of Barakel, the Buzzite, answered and said, "I'm young in years, and you're aged. Therefore, I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion to you. I said, 'Let days speak, and many years speak wisdom.' But it is the spirit in man, the breath of the Almighty, that makes him understand. It's not the old who are wise, nor the aged who understand what is right. Therefore, I say, listen to me. Let me also declare my opinion.
I think this is hilarious. This guy, here's, so if you ever knew a guy that was, you know, you might call this the cage stage. Maybe a guy that's recently got really into theology. You know, he's studying theology now. Maybe he's even going to school for such a thing. You know, he's doing that sort of thing. Now, there's going to be a necessity among someone like this to make sure that other people, because you're going to have like strong opinions, but you also need to be perceived as someone who is a righteous person. And so, what do you have going on here? You have a guy saying, "Now listen, I was doing the right thing. I was respecting my elders. I was not going to go out of my place. I said, I am young. You are aged. Let me let the older guys speak and let them many years. I'm going to teach wisdom. I'm here. Maybe I'm going to learn something. I was here to listen. And then I realized that, you know what? It's not the old who are wise. That's not it at all. It's the people that really understand what God is like that are wise. So I need to tell you, you guys got to be quiet and listen to my opinion here." It's basically saying, I was going to just stand here and listen to you guys and learn something. And what I learned is that wisdom is not with the aged.
Yeah. And verse 8, where he says, It is the spirit in man, the breath of the Almighty, that makes him understand. That I believe is his argument for kind of a democratization of wisdom. So he's saying, listen, I've got the breath of the Almighty in me, just like you do. Now, some have argued that he is claiming the gift of inspiration here. I don't buy that. I think we'd have to have some sort of stronger language used to argue that he is claiming to have an elevated gift of the spirit that enables him to claim inspiration. Seems to me that what he's saying here is God's spirit is in you just like it's in me. The breath of the Almighty is in me, and that gives understanding. And this breath of the Almighty, it's the same word, neshama in Hebrew, that occurs back in Genesis 2:7, where you had God breathing into Adam and making him a living person. So I've got the breath of the Almighty in me, just like you do. And that ultimately is what gives us the ability to understand. So, in other words, I can speak even though I'm younger than you are.
Yeah.
Wisdom is not necessarily just with those who have, you know, a few more birthdays behind them.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like an insult here too. I mean, it's so. I mean, like you can picture this guy, man. Like I know this guy. Probably was this guy at one point where you're declaring that you did the right thing, and in doing the right thing, learned that you must do this other thing, which is I yielded to my elders, only to find that you guys really need me.
Yeah, good thing I'm here. So that's his first part. I'm entitled to speak. Now he's going to move on, 11 through 14, to say this. Look, I waited for your words. I listened for your wise sayings while you searched out what to say. I gave you my attention, and behold, there was none among you who refuted Job or who answered his words. Beware, yeah, he says, beware lest you say, we have found wisdom. God may vanquish him, not a man. He has not directed his words against me, and I will not answer him with your speeches. So the first part, first couple of verses there are really not adding anything to the conversation. Elihu is just basically saying, I waited around for you guys. I didn't fall asleep during this back and forth. I was listening to what you said. I listened to what Job said. I gave you my attention. And you know what I found out? I found out that none of you guys could refute Job.
Yeah,
He would speak and you couldn't answer him.
it kind of sounds like he's saying, like, I was waiting around, because they'd be like, I mean, obviously we heard lots of answers to Job, right? I mean, they did a lot of talking back to him. It seems what Elihu is saying is like, I listened to what you guys said, and this is the situation. Job's wrong, but he's won this debate. So here I
Yeah.
come.
Yes. Because who had the last word, right? Job did. There was no response from Eliphaz Bildad so far. Job finished his speech, and you can just kind of picture those three guys looking at each other like, you got anything to add? I don't. Do you? No, I don't have anything else to say. So it's at that point when Elihu steps forward. Now, this verse 13 is, I think you can take it a couple different ways. That's the verse that says, so Elihu tells him to beware. He says, beware. I don't want you to be saying, quote, we have found wisdom. God may vanquish him, not a man. I think it's a couple different ways that can be interpreted. So when they say, when he warns them not to say, we have found wisdom, he could be saying, don't be saying we have found Job to be wise.
Right, that's how I take it, is that
Yeah. And with the implication that perhaps God can vanquish him, but we can't.
yeah,
Yeah, that's.
this is the idea that Elihu thinks that Job's won the argument, and so he doesn't want them to think, well, Job won the argument, I guess he's right. I guess we're going to concede. Elihu's like, wait until Isaac come in here. I mean, let me win this argument for you, and then you'll know that it wasn't that Job was right. It's just that you guys were terrible.
Yeah. So that's one. I think that's a more convincing way. Another way you can read this is, we have found wisdom. Beware lest you say we have found wisdom in ourselves. So we've got wisdom. We found it. But Job won't listen to us. So we're gonna have to let God vanquish him, and he's gonna have to deal with him and not a man. So that's another interpretation that's out there. But contextually, it makes the most sense to me that Elihu is telling his friends, these older guys, don't be going around saying that Job has been the winner of this debate because he has all this wisdom and you're just gonna turn it over to God. Well, listen, we don't need God. I'm here.
Right.
And I'm going to speak for God. I'm going to tell you exactly what you should have said all along. Even though he hasn't, he finishes that in verse 14 by saying that Job hasn't directed his words against me. And of course, that would be true. He hasn't been debating with Elihu. And then he says, I will not answer him with your speeches. So Elihu claims that everything he's going to say is original. Now, we're going to see cases where that is not true. He's going to recycle, in fact, arguments that we heard already in the opening back and forth between Job and his three friends with regard to how God might use suffering to discipline his people. That's going to be Elihu's main contribution to the whole discussion, but that's already been said. So it's not really a contribution that's original to the dialogue here. Well, that's his claim anyway. He's like, I'm not recycling your arguments. I got fresh material here that I'm going to put out here before you, and finally be able to show you what wisdom looks like. So that's the second part. Third part begins with verse 15. They are dismayed. He's talking here, of course, about the three friends. They're dismayed. They answer no more. They have not a word to say. And shall I wait because they don't speak? Because they stand there and answer no more? I also will answer with my share. I also will declare my opinion. For I am full of words.
That's like the most truthful thing for sure that said. There's no lie detected in that statement.
Yeah, I was going to say this is definitely the truest statement that Elihu has made so far. No argument with you there, buddy. You are definitely full of words. I am full of words. The spirit within constrains me. Then he has this image, verse 19, of what it's like for him to be holding in these words. Behold, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. He's got the fire in the belly going on here. Or, as he says, wine. He's got this wine in the belly, expanding and ready to burst. And he's going to pour forth the wine of this wisdom in the speeches that come. I must speak, he says. that I may find relief. I must open my lips and answer. I will not show partiality to any man. The Hebrew there is a Hebrew idiom. It's literally, I will not lift up the face of a man. That's what the Hebrew has anytime you have this idea of showing partiality. So lifting up someone's face. I'm not going to lift up the face. I'm not going to show partiality to anybody or use flattery toward a person. And the Hebrew there is, I'm not going to give honor to someone, but it has this negative implication of flattery in this context. I'm not going to use flattering words toward any person. Or he says, I don't know how to flatter, or else my maker would soon take me away.
I love that. Like, I'm not going to use flattery. I wouldn't even know how.
I wouldn't even know how to do that. Yeah.
I don't
He's
even know how to
just
flatter people. Never done
uses
it.
some pretty self-flattery, it seems to me, in his depiction of his ability to speak wisdom there. But I guess he doesn't know how to flatter other people.
Hey, have never done it, won't ever do it. Don't know how to do it.
So that's the opening chapter about Elihu. I don't know about you, Dan, but I'm pretty getting a pretty good feel for his personality.
Oh yeah.
I mean, he's really all he said so far. He's added nothing to the debate at all. All he said is, "You guys failed. I'm not going to. I listened to you. I waited. You didn't refute Job. I'm mad. I got a lot of things to say. I can say them, and I will say them because I must say them." And that's really all he said so far. Used
Yeah.
a lot of verses to get that across, but that's all that he's said so far.
Yeah,
So,
well, Elihu's like, listen, this book of Job should start at right now. You can forget everything else that was said before this. I'm not going to be referencing any of the things said. All these arguments were terrible. In Elihu's mind, we have wasted our time up to this point, Chad, in the podcast, going up through these. I mean, this was a colossal waste of time. We should have just started right here, and we could have heard the winning argument.
yeah. Well, too late for us, I guess, but let's see what we can learn from this young, angry theologian. So, chapter 33. But now, hear my speech, O Job. So I didn't realize this till this morning. One of the commentaries that I've been using pointed out that the three friends never addressed Job by name. I did not realize that. So Elihu is the only one who does, and he does it more than once. So you should make of that what you want. Some people think it's because Elihu was more closely connected to Job, and so he felt like he could address him by name. Some people think it's actually more kind of an insult, like especially this younger person should not be addressing an older person by their first name. I don't know. I mean, I don't know that we know enough about the cultural context of Job's time to be able to say with certainty, but it is an interesting, at least, detail that the three friends never address Job by name, but Elihu does.
Yeah, I mean,
So,
I don't know if this is a thing in the Hebrew or not, but it's not just that he says Job, but he has this O Job, which, I mean, certainly if I did that, you would know exactly. Like, I mean, if I said, listen to my speech, O Chad, like there's like a you already know that like I am I have not I I've already insulted you, or you know my attitude, right? So again, I don't know if it's really baked in there in the Hebrew, but when you read it, certainly in English, especially since no one has used his
yeah.
name so far, but there's like, but now hear my speech, O Job. Like it's like it's almost like what you would say to somebody who you thought more of themselves than they ought.
It's not in the Hebrew, it is in the translation. But I do appreciate the translation because it does carry that nuance. Let's
Yeah.
put it that way. Yeah.
Yeah, he would say that to insult someone who you thought, yeah, was thinking more of themselves than they ought to think. And so right from the jump, you would be like, just so you know, like I don't think of you that way. But I'll oh, Chad, let me explain to you.
Yeah. So listen up, O Job. I got a lot of words to say. Behold, I open my mouth. The tongue in my mouth speaks. My words declare the uprightness of my heart. And what my lips know, they speak sincerely. The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. That's that same kind of language we heard earlier, by the way, this breath of the Almighty and the Spirit. Answer me if you can, he goes on. Set your words in order before me. Take your stand. Behold, I am toward God as you are. I too was pinched off from a piece of clay. Behold, no fear of me need terrify you. My pressure will not be heavy upon you. I don't really get the impression Job's scared of him. I don't know why Elihu needs to caution Job, saying, listen, don't be terrified by me. I'm just, you know, I was pinched off by the divine potter, just like you were, and made into clay. The same God that made you say made me, so no need to tremble with fear as I address you. I mean,
it is
he does come
weird.
Across as so pompous.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm just a man like you, Job. I know it's easy to confuse me with something other than that, but I'm just a man. Even though I do like this. I don't know why. It's just kind of a cool image. This sort of I was pinched off from a piece of clay. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty good language. If you are trying to say, like, if you were trying to tell someone that you're both equal, and by equal in relation, if you're comparing yourself to God, really nothing. Mm-hmm. Pinched off from a piece of clay is a pretty good description of trying to say, hey, I'm not really anything.
Yeah, that needs to be another one of those Job expressions that we revive, along with being companion of ostriches. You
yes.
know, when things are going really bad in your life, yeah, companion of ostriches. So that one and pinched off from a piece of clay. That's, we need to insert those into more of our work.
Yeah,
so
we do.
I'm
going to make those. I'm going to insert those into some things, but that it's actually like maybe a cool thing to say if you were. It's almost like it's not the appropriate way. So say you were going to go talk to someone who is suffering, and you were trying to comfort them, and then you went in there and said, "Hey, man, I'm here for you. I'm not God. I'm just a man. I'm just like you. I too was pinched off from a piece of clay." But I'm here to suffer with you. That it would seem like that would be like a great way to use kind of a beautiful phrase. But in this context, it comes across just completely disingenuous and like, listen, I know I just stepped in here, and let me tell you, I'm going to open my mouth and I'm going to use my tongue. And man, when I start talking, man, the uprightness of my heart is going to be revealed to all. And yeah. And that might make you think that I'm more than I am, but I'm just a man. But prepare yourself for these divine-like words that are about to flow. It doesn't hit the same way. So it's a nice line, but it's wasted in the
in this context. So he goes on, and here he's going to begin. Before he speaks, he still really hasn't had any contribution besides some good expressions here and there. But he's going to sum up in his own words, and to some extent in the words of Job, some of the claims that Job has made. So before he begins to actually offer a rebuttal or a correction, he's going to try and summarize some of what Job has said. Verse 8. Surely you have spoken in my ears, and I've heard the sound of your words. In other words, I've been listening this entire time. And here's some things that I've heard from you, Job. Verse 9, you say, I am pure, without transgression. I'm clean, and there is no iniquity in me. Behold, he, that is talking about God, behold, God finds occasions against me, and he counts me as his enemy, and he puts my feet in the stocks, and watches all my paths. So this is, I would say it's a fairly accurate representation of what Job has said. Some of it is almost verbatim, in fact. The only issue that I would have with Elihu's summation of at least part of the arguments of Job is that it kind of comes across as if Job is claimed to be sinless, and we both know, we all know that that's not the case. I mean, Job has talked about his errors, he's talked about the sins of his youth. So yes, of course, he has in other passages talked about the fact that he's not committed some heinous sin which has led to the sufferings that he is enduring. This isn't some kind of divine punishment for any iniquity. But you certainly walk away with from this summation on Elihu's part with the impression that Job has claimed that he's some sort of sinless person. But anyway, that's how Elihu summarizes what
Yeah,
Job has said.
I feel like Job's argument has consistently been, because it starts with this, there's an accusation that he must have done something to deserve this. And Job's argument has consistently been not that he is completely righteous and never sinned or like has never done anything even maybe that deserves punishment, but that whether you're comparing him to his friends or comparing him to the rest of mankind, he has done nothing to exceed the sins of anyone else that this would be happening to him. So, like, he looks around and this isn't happening to anyone else. And what we have at the beginning of Job is that of course, Job's not sinless, but Job is positioned as a person that is better. Not just like the same as everybody else, not just like, but better than everyone else. And it seems that everyone knows it. And like, and Job, and the frustration with Job is that that he knows that everyone knows it. He knows his friends know it. And so like this, yeah, this is a little bit skewed, where it's like, oh, he's just saying that you're without iniquity entirely. I mean, there's no transgression. You're completely pure, huh? It's like, no. I'm just saying that, like, look at what's happening to me. And if you compare me with you, there's nothing that like I've done that you haven't done, or in fact, I'm better than you, right? Like, and so that's the whole argument. And so, yeah, I think that this hits a little bit. This overstates what Job is saying.
Yeah. Well, it's like you and I have talked about many other times. I don't know if it was on or off air, but anytime someone begins a response to us by saying, "So what you're saying is
Yeah.
blah, blah, blah," then yeah, 99.9% of the time, that's not what you're saying,
Yeah.
or it's a misrepresentation. It's at least such an incomplete summation of what you're saying that it comes across as a misrepresentation of what you're claiming.
Yeah, I mean, if he had just said here, let me recap your argument, Job. What you're saying is that you have done nothing that is unique from the rest of mankind to deserve this unique punishment. That would be accurate, right? That's Job's whole thing. It's like, I've done nothing that's so unique that my punishment would be so unique.
So that would be a fairer way for Elihu to sum it up. Now he goes on in verse 12. So he, after summarizing what he claims Job has said, "Behold, in this you're not right. I will answer you. For God is greater than man. Why do you contend against him, saying he will answer none of man's words?" That kind of leads up here to what you think is going to be some sort of striking argument, and it's not really much of an argument at all when he says God is greater than man. It's not like Job is going to disagree with that. In fact, that's really the substance of much of what Job has to say. God is greater than man. In fact, he says it in essence, more than once. And because of that, Job can't get his day in court. He can't have any kind of conversation with God because God is, in fact, greater and higher and more powerful than man is. And so there's nothing really that he would be able to do in order to be on the level with God so that he could address him. So verse 13 ends with this, "Why do you contend against him, saying he will answer none of man's words?" Well, Job contends against him because of all the things that Job has said, because he is the innocent sufferer, and what he has been going through is in no way equivalent to what he himself has done with regard to any kind of like horizontal righteousness.
Well, this the implication here too is that look, Job, God is greater than man, which is you're like, thanks, that's great to know, but the that of course he's not going to answer you, like what who are you to like what do you mean what do you what, like so you're going to contend against him and say he'll answer none of my words. Well, he's God. So I mean, why would he answer you? And then he's going to go on to say, like, he only speaks in like one or two ways. By the way, he's like straight up wrong right here. But what he definitely is saying is that God's not going to talk to you like a person.
So he goes on to say, God speaks in one way or in two, though man doesn't perceive it. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on men while they slumber on their beds. So while people are asleep, Elihu says, God does communicate. He speaks. And what's the goal of the speech? He says he opens the ears of men. Literally in Hebrew, he uncovers their ears and terrifies them with warnings that he may turn man aside from his deed and conceal pride from a man. He keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword.
What a bummer. Like that, like
That
this is the only way that God's gonna ever talk to you is like he's gonna give you a dream in the middle of the night. And by the way, you're gonna wake up in a sweat because you're gonna be terrified about what you saw.
I'm sure glad this isn't the only way that God communicates is by divine nightmares to warn us away from going to hell. That was, yeah, I don't know that I'd ever go to bed. But yeah, that's so that's Elihu's solution to the problem. Oh, God's going to communicate. He gives you nightmares that warn you not to go to hell. I mean, that's basically the gist of this communication. Well, I'm not disputing the fact that God gives dreams and visions. We have those all over the scriptures. But this is not, thank God, the only way that communication takes
Or if
place.
he does give a dream or vision, it's not always this.
It's not always this. Yeah, exactly. In fact, most of the time, it's not such a negative kind of communication,
It
but
almost seems like he's like, listen, Job, God's not going to talk to you, like have a conversation with you using words. There's only one way that he's going to talk to you, and it's when you're asleep and he gives you this nightmare. Maybe you should have listened to that, Job. Maybe when you had that nightmare, you should have listened and not done whatever it is that you did, right? And it's,
yes.
yeah, this, again, this might make it difficult for this to be Jesus because you're like, that's not true.
Does this no? Doesn't sound very much like what Jesus would say.
No. I also liked it. He's like, don't worry, Job. My words won't be burdensome at all. But, and then he lays
And
out
then he lays
the.
this on. I don't know. Elihu feels pretty heavy to me. Your yoke is not easy and your burden is not light that you're
No.
putting on me. A 90-pound sack of rocks that you just laid on my back.
For sure. All right, man. Well, that is it. We are out of time. We will definitely be hearing more from Elihu. He's got a lot of words, as he has stated, and we're gonna explore more of those, but we're gonna have to wait until next week to do that. I'll see you then, Chad.
See you then.